Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is WTF. It's my podcast. Welcome to it. Hope you're hanging in. I hope that the holidays, the first wave, didn't beat you down too much. Maybe even had a nice time. I don't know. I underplayed it dramatically. Today on the show, my old buddy Joe Matarese is here. Joe and I kind of started together back in New York, and he's got a podcast called Fixing Joe, and he's also got a CISO comedy special coming up. That's this Thursday, December 1st. But I haven't talked to him in a while, and I always liked Joe, despite the fact that he never seemed to believe that I liked him, because I was hung up on a joke of his that I still like, but he thinks I'm fucking with him for some reason. Perhaps I'll bring that up in the conversation. I'm going to be in Chicago this Saturday, December 3rd, for two shows at the Vic. You can go to WTFpod.com/tour to get the link up for tickets. I think the first show might be sold out. Second show is, I think there's still tickets. I don't keep in, you know, on top of this. I'm excited. I don't know how cold it is. But I got to get, I'm preparing for it here in L.A. It got chilly in L.A. It's a brisk 55 degrees right now, and I'm wearing a toque and a flannel over a T-shirt. I layered up. What else have I got coming up? In the immediate future, not till January 24th, I'll be at the Ruby Diamond Concert Hall in Tallahassee, Florida. February 17th, I'll be at the Carolina Theater in Durham, North Carolina. On February 18th, I'll be at the Knight Theater in Charlotte, North Carolina. And then March 2nd, the Ridgefield Playhouse. That's in Ridgefield, Connecticut. March 3rd, the Music Hall in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. College Street Music Hall in New Haven, Connecticut on March 10th. Troy Savings Bank Music Hall. A lot of coming up. I got Burlington coming up, and we're adding more dates on into the spring. You can go to WTFpod.com/tour for all those dates. There's going to be a bunch of new ones going to be up there soon. I've been having some experiences. You know, I read an article, HuffPost piece, on the escalation in heckling since the election of Trump. The escalation in, nasty, name-calling heckling, or just a sort of ease in which people say shitty things about ethnic groups or about liberals. That buzzword is back, the liberal, the broad liberal buzzword. You know, some people are Democrats, some people are Republicans, some people are independents, but like liberal takes on this whole sort of like, bleh. Like it even means anything to anybody who uses it in that tone. But it's back. It's been here before, familiar with it. But I work as a comic, and you have to sort of figure out the angle in terms of how you're going to talk about this stuff. And I've been almost non-political for most of the run of this podcast, give or take certain issues that affect me personally, and this affects me personally, so I'm going to talk about it, but I'm not it's not about alienating people. It's just about having an emotional response. And then, yeah, I'm watching other comics and they're nervous. Everybody's nervous. Nobody knows what's going to happen. They don't, you know, they're nervous about the president, whether they voted for him or not, the new president that's going to come in. They're nervous about the country. They're nervous about everything. It's very, and people get afraid to talk up there. But you got to express your feelings if that's the kind of comic you are. And you have to realize what the fuck is up. You know, where I don't know where people are getting their information or what they're basing their engagement with reality on. I know that there's a general lack of a sense of the interconnectedness of humanity because we're all so fucking detached and just sort of shut into our own little worlds, our own little cliques, our own little communities, our own little homes, our own little, you know, online avatars and screen names. I don't know where people have, what is the collection? What is the collective? What holds us together? People don't get their news from the same place. Most people get their news from clickbait and hearsay with the occasional catchy meme. There's no barometer of truth or integrity to most of the information that's out there. So people like, you know, well, how do you know? Yeah, you read a what? You read an article? Well, how do you know it's true? Who knows anymore what's true or what's, you know, I just kind of, yeah, I kind of click around, kind of, you know, surf a little bit, take in some, you know, just read the headlines and then, you know, hear, like, take in what people tell me. You know, I see some pictures and, you know, whatever sticks, that's, you know, whatever I feel in my gut is truth. That's what's truth. Well, that's not real, not really good integrity barometer of any truth. It's like, yeah, what's integrity? What does that even mean anymore? It's not even a word, I don't think. That's a made up word. Journalistic integrity, that is a talking point. All right, so you just find news that fits your particular point of view and makes you comfortable in your personal truth. Whatever that is, left or right. Yeah, that's pretty much it. Well, terrific. So that's out. There's no collective sensibility about the integrity of information. So as a comic, you know, yeah, all I can do is what I've been doing for the last couple of decades, and that's, you know, speak from my heart and react to what's going on. Now, I'm prepared to process and deal with heckling in the moment. It's not something I have a problem with. It's something I learned early on. It's a skill set that as a comic you either lock into and you learn how to do or you don't. I did. I don't take any shit up there. That's our space. That's your comic space. You know, first of all, heckling in general, you know, despite what anyone is saying, it's not right. You're supposed to behave like a fucking audience member. But it seems to be an established type of thing that people, like, heckling is a thing we have to deal with continually. And now the idea that there's an upsurge in inappropriate heckling, you know, some hecklers help the show, some hecklers, you know, want to have a conversation, yeah, but some hecklers are just, you know, kind of fuck you people, and we know who the fuck you people are. Here's the interesting thing. Look, I'm not having some, you know, major issue in you know, accepting as an American the election. I mean, I'm not, you know, I'm not naive. Yes, the election is done. We have a new president. But the only thing that the popular election, if anything, implies, other than the number of votes one candidate had over the other, it's not a matter of winning or losing. But what it is a matter of is there is no social mandate for being a douchebag in public. There is no majority. This is a minority rule. It's the way the republic works. It's the way democracy works in this country. I understand that. But the numbers do not and should not give anyone a social mandate to be a fucking douchebag in public and treat people badly and say shit that they know that they shouldn't have said. It's still, this is what's going to have to happen ultimately, is that people who respect humanity, whatever side you're on, who respect the collective idea of what our country represents, which is we all live together, we're all Americans, you're going to be called upon, if you're a decent person, no matter who you voted for, we're going to have to say in public situations, hey, you know what? Hey, it's still not okay to do that. No, there's, you don't have license to do that. And whatever that is, you fill in the blank for yourself. Oh, whoa. It's, you know what? It's not okay to say that. I'm not saying it's against the law. You have a constitutional right to do it. But socially, in the world we live in, in, you know, American culture and society. It's like, you know, act like a fucking person. So there is no social mandate for being a douchebag in public. I understand people are excited on both sides, but that's just the truth of it. And that, as a comic, is something we're all going to have to deal with. It's like, if you don't like the show, leave. If you want to make a spectacle out of yourself while you're leaving, fine. If you want to talk out during the show, I'll deal with you for a little while. But ultimately, you're just ruining the show for a lot of people that wanted to see the show because of your opinions in that context. There is no social mandate for being a douchebag in public. Try to act like a human being. You know what they are. This is a bipartisan request. So Joe Matarese and I go way back. I don't know that we were like buddies, but we were around each other, and I always liked him. I always liked Joe. Very nice guy. I liked watching him do stand-up. I just liked him. And we never had any real beef. He lives in New York, and, you know, I know he's got this podcast going. We've been trying to figure out, you know, how to get him on, and because he's not out here a lot, and I was happy we put this in the can a while back. And there's a couple interesting things going on for Joe. As I said earlier, he's got a new comedy special on CISO that premieres this Thursday, December 1st. He also has a podcast called Fixing Joe. You can get it wherever you get podcasts. But also, he's doing this interesting thing. He's making a TV show based on his podcast and web series, okay? And on Fixing Joe. And he's looking for writers. So if you're interested, and this is real, if you're interested, you can go to joematarese.com to take a look at his web series, read the show description, and contact him through the email listed on the site if you want to be a writer for Joe's new show. This is a very democratic way to do that. I don't know if Joe knows what he's gotten himself into, but that's what he told me to tell you, and I'm telling you that right now. And now let's talk to my old pal Joe Matarese.
I had a moment, believe it or not,
yeah,
listening to one of your interviews, and I don't know if I should say which comedian it was.
Sure.
I was listening to the Al Lubell episode. And I'm sure
it's a great episode.
It wasn't that long ago, so you probably...
It's a great episode.
I don't know how detailed your memory is for different
interviews.
Sometimes. Well, he mentioned to you that he was jealous of your neuroses because yours was more masculine than his. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
And he said what he hates about his is that he can't make decisions.
Yeah.
And he has to ask everybody what they think. And he said, you come across more like tough.
Yeah.
And I remember I was driving home from a gig. I was at Laugh Boston.
Yeah.
And I wasn't happy with how I did.
Yeah.
I don't know. It was one of those like the last show was the worst one.
All right. Not horrible, but bad enough to ruin all the other ones?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The last one was bad, and I got an email. Oh, my God. Do you ever get the email from a fan?
Right after the show?
The next morning.
Oh,
dude,
yeah.
I open my email.
Yeah.
I'm still at the Starbucks in the hotel that Laugh Boston is in.
Before you drove home?
Before I drove home.
Yeah.
I open an email, and it just says, hey, man, was at your show last night. You might want to up your meds. I don't know what's going on with you, but it wasn't funny, and you seem like you're in a bad place. You might want to, like, get your wife to psychoanalyze you some more and fix you, like, because I have a psychologist wife.
Right.
And he was just like, it wasn't funny. It wasn't good. Just really nasty, negative shit about my show.
But was it like, was he being a douchebag or he just didn't get it? Was he just disappointed? Or
no, he was right. That's what it was. I didn't have a good show.
Right. But he didn't, you could just say, hey, happens, you know, it's, you know, the other shows were good. You can put it into perspective.
You could do that. But something hit me where I was
I hate when they hit. Where like they just somehow read exactly what you think you might have gotten away with it with some people. And then they're just sort of like, they tell you exactly what you were thinking.
Yes. And then also, it was Easter.
Yeah.
And I was missing like the candy exchange.
Right.
I was
because you still had to drive 4 hours or what?
I won't be home till noon. Right. They already had their Easter baskets.
Right.
Not a big deal in my house,
right.
Really.
Right.
But my kids are only 8 and 4 years old. They don't know that.
But that guy didn't, like, you didn't need to up your meds. You just had a shit. What was it? The second show Saturday?
Yeah.
Fucking.
Well, this is what, I don't know if you ever did Laugh Boston. It's in this hotel, and usually the audience is whatever corporate event is going on in the hotel.
Worst.
Yes. Yeah. So that's what it was. Now, you're at a point where you finally get your fans, but I hear you on your podcast talk about doing shows sometimes where you got some other people that just came.
Yeah, you got to do the work.
Well, yeah. Well, I'm at the level that it's almost all people that just came.
And a few fans. Yeah, it's hard for those fans to understand.
Yeah. So, like, when you talk really honestly about being on medications, you're being a dad, and you're 22 years old, you're kind of lost sometimes. Like, I don't really want them in the audience.
Don't say that.
I mean, I want them, but I mean, I've come to the point where I'm like, in my head, I'm going, if everyone here was like 35 to like 70.
Yeah.
This is a home run 95% of the time.
Oh, no, I agree with you. It's nice to have a grown up audience.
Grown up. Yes.
Right. So what'd you write back to this kid? What happened?
I wish I could pull up the email right now, but I wrote him back. Like,
what do you mean?
I just said like, dude, you fucking hurt my feelings. It's Easter morning. Do I really need to, you know, I got to drive all the way home. This is what I wake up to. And I'm feeling kind of shitty. And I start driving, and I put on your episode with Al Lubell.
Right.
And he's talking about not being able to make decisions.
Yeah.
And it just fucking hit me like a punch in the face, like a punch right in the nose where your nose bleeds.
Yeah.
I was like, I can't make decisions. No wonder I can't make decisions. I do a podcast called Fixing Joe where the audience and my guest is trying to fix me. They're helping me with every single thing in my life. I go, that's pathetic. That's not a confident stance. I go, you're done. It's not Fixing Joe anymore. I want to be able to make decisions. And I was like, driving my wife crazy, returning everything I would buy. From car, wanting to return a house, you know, like just stuff you can't return. Yeah, like I was at that, like we went through a point where the house we were living in before, the house we live in now.
Yeah.
Like I couldn't just move forward. I would just be like, we got to fix this and we got to fix it. Like I have a brother who's in construction.
Yeah.
Really? He used to be for many years. He was like a general contractor. He knows how to do everything. So whenever I would go to do something or want to do something, hey, do you think I should do this? What do you think here? You know, I'm returning stoves and dishwashers.
Oh, that's true.
I'm torturing people.
So anxiety ridden.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know if what I'm doing is the right way to do things. Because I get jealous of people that just sort of get things done. Because really, once you set things in motion, like it's all about dread.
Uh-huh.
But like you're actually buying shit and giving it back. But I bought this washing machine I'm not happy with because I don't think it's cleaning things. But
you don't return it.
Well, I made some calls. and the thing is that they don't make them any different now. The old style washing machine with the real thing, the agitator, that fills up all the way, they don't exist anymore hardly. It's all this low water, water efficiency, no big agitator shit.
Right.
So like I guess what I'm gleaning is that we all just have to live with slightly dirty clothes now because that's the way it is.
Well, what I'm learning is like a version of that, which is just move forward, man.
Yeah.
Stop moving backwards so much. Because I got to tell you, when I heard that interview with Lubell.
You didn't want to be Al Lubell.
I felt bad. I wanted to drive to your house and hug Al Lubell.
I'm trying to remember like the last time we were in the same world, you know, like where, because I know you get mad at me because I always quote this joke of yours.
You've mentioned it on your show. Yeah.
Like several times.
Mm-hmm.
I don't
several?
Know. Maybe twice. I don't know. No, but I mean, it was like, because there was a time, I guess I'm a little older than you, but you were kind of around. And when I was living in New York, when did you start?
I started comedy in 89, believe it or not.
Right. Okay. Jesus. So yeah, and that's not much longer after me. So we were in New York around the same time, and you had your kind of spiky hair, good looking guy doing your thing. I always thought you were some sort of, you know, bro.
I'm sure you did.
Yeah, but you I think I've
I think I was. Yeah. I think I've evolved away from
it. No. I definitely think that. But it's just so funny how sometimes you hold people in this place. And mm-hmm. then, like, I would see you around, and then I knew you had this, that you were struggling with things, and you were doing it publicly, and then you did the podcast. Did you get divorced, too?
Never got divorced somehow. I just didn't get married until I was a lot older.
Okay.
I didn't do the young marriages. I had a long couple of long relationships, but somehow didn't marry them.
Yeah.
Luckily.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember, like, because, I mean, we didn't know each other that well, but we knew each other well enough. We were around, like, stand-up New York and shit, right?
Yeah. I have one vivid memory about you.
Oh, yeah? Is it a bad one?
Yeah, kind
of. What happened?
But you didn't piss me off or anything.
Right.
I just, for some reason, we didn't hang, you
and I. I don't
know.
Did you decide I didn't like you or something?
No. I just think... you were one of those guys. You know what you kind of remind me of?
What?
Like, when I started in 89 in Philadelphia.
Really? A Philly guy?
Yeah. I did my open mics at this place called the Comedy Works and the Comedy Factory Outlet. They were across the street from each other in
With
Philadelphia.
With Kurt? No, it was
way before that. Yeah. My guys were, Paul F. Tompkins was the host of my open mic.
Yeah.
And Todd Glass was a couple years before me. And believe it or not, Adam McKay.
Yeah.
You know,
really,
the Adam McKay was at, you know, and did open mics with me also.
Uh huh.
And those guys hated me
because you were a bro.
Yeah,
right.
And I had a mullet. I had Cavaricci pants. It was bad. I did a Nicholson impression. I mean, everything you shouldn't do, I was doing.
Well, you were doing what you thought you had to do to do the job.
I didn't know that you could be yourself.
Right.
I really didn't.
But you're from Jersey.
Mm-hmm. I used to drive over the bridge, sign up for the open mic. I lived 15 minutes away.
From Philly
in Cherry Hill, New Jersey.
So it was easier than going to New York.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I waited 4.5 years before I moved to New York.
So wait, you're going to Philly, you're doing Nicholson, you got a mullet.
Yeah.
What
and
did
the
you
comics go- would yell, no, from the back. And I would still do it. You know those guys that just keep doing the same bit that works at open mic?
Yeah.
And you don't, I know now, but back then you didn't know that you should be doing new shit and evolving.
Well, they're trying to help you.
Yeah. Don't! Still remember this guy, John Matta. Don't! And I would put the hand on the head.
Oh, did it all, huh?
The things that Dennis Miller made fun of,
mm-hmm.
I was doing.
Well, he used to be a prop comic. Don't put
Did
it
he?
Too high. Yeah.
Well, that's good to know.
Yeah, there you go. Take that.
Dennis Miller did props.
He did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know what it was is when I started, I would do what other comedians were doing.
Yeah.
That's what I would do. I would go, oh, they do jokes about commercials. I should do jokes about a commercial. I didn't talk about me.
Well, no, but that's not a bad mistake. I mean, you're figuring mm-hmm. out how to do comedy.
Right.
You know what I mean? I mean, some of those, like Adam McKay doesn't even do stand-up anymore.
No, he did it for a short amount. But
right.
But he was weird and alty. So was Paul F. Tompkins.
I know, but they...
But were, I like them when I was coming
There's nothing wrong
up.
With... Yeah, but like what I'm saying is that, you know, whatever they eventually ended up doing, broadening whatever they became, it's like you wanted to do club comedy.
I was tougher then. I wasn't as neurotic as I am now.
Yeah, that's a question that's sort of interesting to me, is that like you always struck me as a guy. What'd you grow up like? Italian, working class? What was it?
100% Italian, but not really. You know what's odd is not really working class. Like I do jokes years ago a lot about not being an Italian. You know,
yeah.
My dad is a chemical engineer.
Yeah.
I used to say I'm more of an Alan Alda Italian. That's what my dad, he's not a Tony Soprano, he's an Alan Alda, you know, because people don't realize Alan Alda's Italian.
He is.
But he is.
Yeah.
My mom, more of the stereotypical Italian. Like my mom, I would describe as Ray Romano's mother on Everybody Loves Raymond. That's my mom and my grandma are very similar.
Right, but still, like it's how you're gonna enculture yourself in high school and grade school. It's saying who's gonna be. I imagine most of what defined you was who you're hanging around.
Sure,
and like you know, you must have been hanging around
with
those
the
guys.
Bros. Yeah, That's why, and you know what? It's funny. That's why you end up moving. And you also end up moving away from your family. If you feel different, I guess I was, like I said, I wasn't being me.
Right.
Like, I was being these guys.
But you felt that.
But
you
could feel it, because I knew I wanted to be a comedian even at 15 and 16.
Yeah, I went through a lot of different personalities. Like, I wasn't just, you know what I mean? Like, I could sort of move freely through a lot of different groups. I mean, culturally, you know, I wasn't Italian, I was Jewish, but I was in New Mexico, it didn't matter. But I went through a little bit of a hippie period, a little bit of a new wavy kind. Like, I would kind of move around.
Me too. I was more of the hippie, like, 10th grade in high school.
Oh, yeah?
I had the long hair, everybody had the rock t-shirts and the...
But you were a rock guy.
I was into rock. I would go to a lot of...
Concert
t-shirts? I smoked
t-shirts?
A lot of pot and went to a lot of rock shows.
Who was your band's in?
I always liked Rush growing up.
You were a Rush guy.
I was a Rush guy. I got to admit it.
Wow. Like, I need to, like, I've been criticized for giving Rush short shrift on the show. Like, I've dissed Rush a bit.
You have?
Well, yeah, I have. But I saw them three times. Look, I'm not going to deny that they're great musicians.
That's what they are. I was a guitar player in high
school. And 2112 is great.
Yes.
It's great.
Yes.
Yeah, what is that? Da-na,
yeah. But now, I think I have all... Yeah, I love that you're just... Dude, buy it. There was nothing more fun than when you played guitar and getting your first echo pedal and getting to go... Dun, 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 dun. I was like, yes!
You play guitar?
I did, in high school, yeah.
Oh, you were going for the full rock guy.
I played in some bands, but I never got... great at that. I used to bail on a lot of things. Stand up is really the only thing in my life I didn't bail on.
Me too.
You too? But you still play guitar, like, you're very good.
Yeah, but I don't play, never played in bands, never had the confidence. You know what I mean? Like, I should play with guys now.
Mm-hmm.
That would be just for fun, but like I never had the confidence. Like I think the thing with stand up was, like, it's a weird thing, like, because some people are like, how do you do that? They don't understand how you do it. I don't know how not to do it after a certain point. Like, even at the beginning where it was like, this is going to suck. Like, you do that first, those open mics, and, like, it wouldn't be that great. And, like, and then you sometimes have weeks in between them just going like, oh, my God. Fuck, I got it, you know.
Yeah.
And you kept doing it.
Yeah.
Because no one could tell you anything. I don't know what. I can't ever figure out what the hell it is, why that was the thing.
I think because I wasn't smart enough. That I actually, if I got the littlest response, that meant going well early on. You were like, that went great.
But
they laughed a little.
So you were never a sports guy. You were a rock guy.
I was a sports guy, though, too.
Oh.
I played sports, but I quit. I bailed on that, too, at like ninth grade.
What was it, baseball?
Yeah. You know what? I had my first anxiety attack. Oh, this is... I love the shit that's come. You're like, you know, you're being interviewed by someone who's a really good interview.
What?
When shit just jogs.
Oh, really? Is that the trick?
I really think it is. Don't you love that feeling when you're like, that just opened the side of my
head.
It's
the best. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So wait. So you're in ninth grade. You were playing ball.
I was playing ball.
But did you know it was an anxiety attack?
No.
What happened?
I remember, and it's in my Comedy Central half hour, the whole long story.
Right.
But it was true. I bought some pot off a kid at school. I went home. I smoked this whole joint. I don't know what was going on in my head now, even now that I think about it.
Yeah.
But I drank really two big glasses of vodka.
Before a game?
I had a game that night. What the I have no idea. But like hours later,
right?
The game, you know?
Yeah.
And I thought it was just like something was in the pot. All of a sudden, just like this like trippy feeling went through my body. You know, like the tingling and everything that an anxiety attack is, but I didn't know because I was so young. I was like, what the hell? I started running. I went outside. I just started running.
Oh, my God.
Around my neighborhood trying to work off this buzz of some sort. Made it worse. Got so paranoid that I told my mother that I was high.
Yeah.
I said, I smoked pot. I know you don't know this, but I smoked pot and I can't breathe.
And
I'm like, I think I'm going to die. And my Italian mom, drove me to the pediatrician. I swear to God. She must have been afraid if she took me to a hospital that we would get arrested.
Right. She didn't know.
And I had to tell the pediatrician that I smoked.
This is ninth grade?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ninth grade. And oh my God. And I felt high for like a day and a half.
Huh.
Like it just felt like it never went away. I didn't make the game. I never went to the game. And to me, that represents the end of sports. Yeah. I don't remember.
For everybody.
It was a big game for everybody.
That was the day sports died in America.
Yeah. I remember being very good at baseball. That was really my sport. I wasn't like the jock across the board.
So just maybe baseball. You're married to a psychologist.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine you see a therapist. Or you
I
did.
Don't anymore. I did for 7 years. This guy that everybody saw in New York City that sees only comedians.
Right,
have you heard about him on your show?
Yeah, what's his name?
You've heard him on the show?
I've heard about him.
His name's Alan Lefkowitz.
Yeah. But, what's the diagnosis there? That you just had a fear of success or failure? Or because it sounds like all that stuff is, you know, you not being able to make a decision and then sabotaging your ability to do the ball game. Like I don't know exactly what that comes from. I mean, I think I've done that in my life.
Well, I found out later in life also that my dad has this anxiety thing too.
Oh yeah.
And it kind of runs in our family. My brother had it.
Have the one brother?
I have a sister and a brother.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he had it too?
Well, he probably wouldn't appreciate me saying it on your show, but I think he definitely struggles with anxiety, and our anxiety would you're more intellectual than me, transpose.
Yeah.
What would you say? It would surface as anger.
Oh, yeah.
Because everybody that knows me from the time of stand-up that you know me from in New York, and I don't know if you were ever in the room to witness it, when I would lose my shit.
On stage?
Yes.
I love that.
Comics would love it. Jim Florentine would egg it on. I was a snapper.
The guy's gonna snap.
But it was like my Pete Dominic. I don't know. You know Pete?
Yeah.
Pete called it Jekylling.
Uh huh.
Because I would be completely. I'm a very easygoing, happy guy.
And then one button.
Boom.
Rage. Yeah, I did the same thing.
What the fuck?
Mine's always right there.
But it went away with the medication. I haven't had it happen in like. I swear to God, I'm like 6 years rage free.
Really?
Yeah, the medication took it away.
Because I'm doing the I'm not doing medication, and I'm doing it cognitively.
How do you do that?
I try and stay away from people that provoke me too much.
But on stage, there's always going to be somebody that goes, "You're soft."
I've become very diplomatic with that.
Age makes caring as much.
I guess so, but I'm also pretty open up there. You know where. Like, even with trolling in general, like, trolling's different, but, like, on stage, like, I'll engage somebody, like, even if they don't know who I am, I'll be like, all right, so look, like, Stuart Lee said a very powerful thing to me. He goes, like, he had a realization. He quit comedy. He's a British comedian.
I know he is.
He's genius. But he quit because, you know, he didn't want to deal with these idiots anymore. Like, basically, the thing was when he came back, the realization he had was that if somebody doesn't like you in the room, he feels bad for them now because like they didn't make the right entertainment decision. You know what I mean?
Like Norm Macdonald has a similar.
Does he?
He says that's kind of funny, you know, and it doesn't work. Yeah, they paid to see something funny and it's not. You know, it's funny. I was like, I love that.
But he has a little empathy towards it that like, especially if they don't know you and they're just sort of like, this sucks. I'm like, yeah, I'm not your guy.
Yeah.
You know, wait, there's another guy after me or whatever you want to do. But like, how about we don't fuck up the show?
Right.
I mean, I understand your plight.
See, what you're saying is me on meds. That's how it goes through my brain now.
But you never tried to work that shit out?
Oh, just 7 years of therapy and it didn't fucking touch it. It just, it would still happen.
So you believe that this is just a chemical basis to this?
It must be. It doesn't happen. And it would happen
because your parents are nice people. They're still together.
My dad's the same way. He's the nicest guy. But I can. There's times growing up where he snapped, and it was like, "Whoa, Dad's scary now."
Yeah.
And it would be physical at times.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my dad hates it. I've said it on my podcast, but my dad fucking tackled me when I was in high school.
Well, you got that happen.
Broke my leg.
He broke your leg?
He broke my leg and didn't apologize.
Wow.
And it went like 30 years of me going, well, yeah.
He broke it in violence or by accident?
Well, in the violent act of, you know, me cursing my mom out at the dinner table.
Oh, he's, so she, provoked him.
Yeah. Him saying you're grounded and me saying, no, not only do I not care that I just cursed at mom, I'm going right out the front door. I'm not grounded. And then my dad's 6'3". He's a big guy. He jumped on top of me and my leg just gave out on the front steps and broken leg. And he's like, it ain't broke. You know, never apologize. And
he apologized yet?
He apologized through Alan Lefkowitz saying, does that bother you that he never apologized? And I said, yeah, it kind of does. I just realized it in here that it does. And he goes, what else bothers you? I go, well, my dad never said he loved me ever. He's like, would you like him to? I'm like, yeah, I think that'd be kind of nice. He goes, tell him it hurts you. Don't tell him you're mad. Tell him it upsets you. He goes, no one can get mad at you saying, hey, man, that hurts.
Yeah.
Which became like a great thing in life just to be able to, when people fucking do shitty shit, just go, hey, man.
So did you do it to your dad?
I called him on the phone like.
Right
after. I'm parked in front of the therapist. And my dad's like, I never apologized for that. I'm like, no. He goes, oh, I'm sorry, man. I'm sorry. And I go, you also never said that you loved me. And, you know, I think it kind of could be a reason why I lose my shit on stage, which I thought, but I don't think that really was. And he's like, you need to hear that? I go, Dad, I do stand-up comedy. Yeah. Yes.
The damage is already done.
No, but meaning that's why I do it, because there's these fucked up things that's why I think sometimes guys go into comedy. It's
really?
Sometimes
they're looking for that love?
Love, yeah. Mm. Maybe.
No, I mean, I've heard that. I believe that's true because, like, I always fought it, though, because I seem to do what you did, like, but not so much. You were always pretty pleasant up there when you were doing your act, right?
Pleasant. And then,
and then you'd snap. But, like, I really think I went up there to challenge an audience, like, from right out of the gate. Like, you know, I was going to challenge them to love me and then be like, yeah, see, not lovable, right? Like, you know.
So you make it funny. It's funny.
It wasn't funny for years,
that's
really.
That's funny to me. I mean, it would go over as not funny.
I don't know. You remember seeing me back then?
Yeah, I always thought it was funny. But yeah, sometimes the audience, they just don't get it.
Well, I'm not sure there was something to get. They were like, this guy's got problems. He seems like he's mad about something.
Now, tell me if I'm wrong on this. Because, you know, I went to the Comedy Store last night. I didn't perform. I just kind of watched a friend of mine go on And I had lived in L.A. for a short time.
Yeah.
And I always feel that the difference between stand-up out here versus New York, and why I kind of like West Coast comedy more, whereas New Yorkers usually come to the West Coast and they're like, fuck these comics. Yeah. They need it. They need it. It's easier here or whatever.
Comedy Store's not easy.
No. I find that the audience, or if it's just the comedians, I feel that they do weirder stuff. Like, they go another route. It's more traditional in New York.
Sure.
It's kind of boring. Like, I like that.
In the clubs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, especially New York. And why is it? Is it because of the comedians, or is it because the audience in New York is more...
I think, like, you know, now, like, if we're just talking specifically about clubs, like the Cellar, the Stand, Gotham, you know, the club scene, because there's an alt scene that's its own thing there, as there is here. But, like, when you're dealing with... Like the store, were you in the little room? Where did he perform?
When I lived in LA?
No, when you were there last night.
Oh, he performed in the, I guess that's the original, right?
Right.
The original, yeah. I watched Bobby Lee went on.
Oh, yeah. Well, that room's like the Cellar.
But it seemed great.
Yeah, no, you got to show up for work.
It was
packed,
though.
Yeah. It's popular again in that place.
Just, you know, when we're at that level of comedy, you can walk in 5 seconds, you go,
oh, that's good.
Good crowd.
Yeah. Well, those guys are all, they're firing on all cylinders.
Right.
You know, but I think there is a little different context. There is a different. There are some guys you'll see that start in New York and they go with the New York style, but you know, a guy like Bobby Lee, he's a big, you know, he does a big physical act,
right?
I mean, part of the reason is that you don't have that much room on the stages in New York. You're not
that's true,
you know,
yeah,
what I
small.
Mean like the Stand is, what is it, like this, like this, like I mean, I've only been there once. It's a tiny stage and the Cellar is very restrictive. You just have that little area and there's a fucking piano there, and then you got about like what, 6 feet and about 3-4 feet in between you and the crowd,
right?
Not, but I mean, that's obviously not the only reason, but for someone like Bobby, he's got needs some room,
right?
but
you doing that conversational style and like saying what you just said, where you said, well, Eric, I tested you. What was the line? I pushed you.
Just challenged you.
Yeah.
Challenged like, you to love me.
Yeah. Well, like that feels like it would work it here does, better sure. than it would in like.
No, I think that's true. I think that New York that my thoughts about it was always, you know, you got to be really punchline efficient and you got to keep it coming.
Uh-huh.
You know, they don't indulge much, you know, dicking around. You know, you can't, like here, once you find a freedom to it, like a room that you're comfortable in, you can try things. Like, I don't, the Comedy Store is like, I'm very comfortable there. So, I'll, you know, I don't mind bombing a bit.
But it also seems like.
But also you had Esty standing there going, oh, that wasn't funny. You know, yeah. Like, you know, like you're always being tested.
I think cause, maybe because here you're in the heart of show business. I mean, there's posters everywhere you look, there's another comedian on a billboard.
It's part of the city.
Well, yeah, and I feel that if you're
that might be true.
And when you're being yourself on stage, like you're saying, that's so Marc Maron, you're
right.
saying what you just said,
right?
That here they
give you the benefit of the doubt.
Not only do they give you the benefit, I think it resonates as they can imagine that, like, on a television show.
I think that's
show.
True. I think that there might be a more, like, everybody likes seeing stars,
uh-huh.
you know, show up.
Right.
And I think that a lot of times, like, the Comedy Store, most of the people up there, they've seen somewhere a lot of times.
Right.
Where in New York, you still got a lot of guys who are just doing the job.
It's the job there. That's yeah. Here, it's like, how do I get this to not be my job?
Yeah,
how do
get
I get
more.
To, yeah, get more. Where it's like, okay, you know.
They're a little more excited here, too, in a way. You know what I mean? It's not just here. You got to you drive in a place. You're gonna go out. Like sometimes in New York, you feel like people are just sort of like, "Oh, let's go in here. It's here."
Right.
And they walk over. You know what I mean? Like I think it's a bigger. Sometimes it's a little bigger deal to go out here.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I'm noticing that at this time around, and what I have going on this week.
What
is
are you
like,
doing?
I have all these pitch meetings set up that my manager put a sizzle reel together of my last 1 hour special.
Yeah.
And he connected it with this web series that we shot
yeah.
that showed a lot of my neuroses. I did a web series called Fixing Joe
yeah.
that had all actors playing all the other parts.
Right.
And like, it's probably the best thing I've ever done where I was like, this, I'm like, I almost want to just go into the meetings and be like, here.
It's all here. What do you want from me?
What the fuck? It's done. Like, yeah. But I really don't want to play a comedian on the show. Like, yeah. I want to challenge myself a
sure.
little bit and say, you know, here's this is the show, but I'm not a comedian. I'm just Joe, who's a guy who has
why don't
this
you be a
job.
Construction guy.
Well, yeah, you know, whatever. But
no, I think that's interesting because you'd be like, it's sort of against type to have a dude that looks like a dude,
mm-hmm.
you know, with real kind of anxiety and problems,
and,
neurotic problems.
And
I think you're neurotic in a different way than I am.
Probably am. And I think one thing that I was amazed at my manager, which made me think, wow, he's on board. I didn't think he would be. Like, we had a meeting last week. We went to
who's
dinner.
Your manager?
Rick Dorfman, who everybody knows for 100 years.
Yeah, I had an awkward meeting with Rick Dorfman once, yeah.
I've had 100 awkward conversations with Rick Dorfman. He'll tell you. We fight all the time.
Yeah.
But, like, there was a moment in the meeting where I was like, I don't even care that I fight. Like, he gets me, and he doesn't want me to be another guy. He's like, dude, like I told him the story of wanting my dad to say he loves me and all that stuff. And he's like, dude, you got to use these in the meeting. He's like, you're a good guy.
Yeah.
He's like, you're not like a fucking lunatic. Like I've been married for over 10 years.
Yeah.
And like, I want to be, my parents have been married for 50 years. Like I'm this like sensitive person underneath it all. Like I told you like that tough guy that I was in Jersey and all that
thing.
It just went away.
Yeah, but it didn't it the struggle continues, right? So like the idea of a character like you who's a good guy but kind of an alpha dude, the alpha neurotic guy is not something I've seen a lot. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
It is sort of interesting that like how you would play it where, you know, you don't understand why you have these problems, but some of them are like kind of crazy,
uh-huh.
you know, like not being able to make a decision. And just playing that against your wife or whatever, like,
right.
you know, realizing that the Rage is, that's interesting. That should be, you should be able to sell that show.
We hope, but I mean, and I had to write a log line, which I've never done in my life. Did you ever try to write a log line for your line? Show?
Like Joe is a
Yeah, like what the sitcom is in two sentences.
Yeah. No, I don't know if I ever did that. I always like that. I just go in there and blather and, you know, get some laughs and have them put it together.
That's
But for years, though, it's not a good, it's better to have a log line because for years they think they know you. They don't know you. You got to tell them what you are. Or else they'll just be like, oh, you're that guy. I'm like, really? I didn't think I was that guy. Like, yeah, that's what you are. And I'm like, no, I don't think so.
But I feel like you're probably similar to me when you go into these meetings.
Yeah.
If it doesn't feel genuine and there's not a real connection.
Yeah.
It feels like there's no way we're going to sell right now.
I don't know. You know, it's like I've gone to a lot of those meetings and, you know, you're usually going for laughs and, you know, you listen to them. You want to listen a little bit and, you know, let them chime in and work off what they're saying a little bit. But they rarely go. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the odds are against you, even if you feel good in the room.
Well, I think like Craig,
not helpful.
I had Craig Ferguson on my podcast.
I've had him on.
He's a great guy. And,
yeah.
And he said something. I bring it up all the time and it's simple. But it really makes sense. He defined show business. He compared it to the movie Shawshank Redemption.
Uh-huh.
He said in that movie, Morgan Freeman, for the whole movie, is trying to get paroled. And he's trying fucking so hard. And then at the end of the movie, he's like, basically like, fuck you. You're not going to parole me. You know, he's just basically like, who gives a shit? And boom, they stamp it paroled. He goes, that's show business.
Yeah, that's true.
And I said to you walking in your house, you said, how you like L.A.? And I said, and I think I just defined it talking to one of my friends before I came here. And I said, what is it about L.A.? It feels harder to be your genuine self. Like, and I hate that because it's like you start going, oh, show business is so here.
Do you thank your friends all the time for putting up with?
I should.
Do you tell your friends?
But he appreciated it because he felt the same way. He was like, dude, because he used to be in a couple of different bands that had big almost shots. And he said, I feel so insecure when I'm in L.A. And I said, yeah, it feels harder to be your genuine self. But
if you know what that is, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think we just define what I am. And if I can just if I can just be that and not try to be it. It's like when I watched at the Comedy Store last night, you can tell the comedians that aren't trying to be something.
Right.
And you're like, they're nailing it.
But they're there. You know, it takes a long time. Yeah. Most of those guys have been around a while.
Yeah. They're making it look easy. They're making it like they just, like Ali Wong went up.
She's the best.
She was cracking me the fuck up.
Oh, that's great. Did you watch her special?
I saw like a hair of it.
Oh,
she goes on
it.
Pregnant.
It's great.
I got to check it out because she had me dying.
Well, she's like, she's going to do it her way.
That's what I mean, because you know, I'm a guy that has two little kids, and I'm like, if my wife was here, she'd be fucking dying.
Yeah.
She said some joke about, why are you out? Like, didn't you just have a baby? Why are you out?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And she just pauses, and it's so honest. I love that. She goes, I'm this close to
throwing my baby in the garbage.
I was like, that's yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you're 22, like I said earlier, you're like, that's the meanest joke. Oh, why are you saying that? Like you have to have lived life to realize why that's funny.
I think there's a lot of people coming to the clubs now that are a little more older and a little more like I don't know what it is, but like I've been fortunate to sort of cultivate an audience that gets me in whatever the fuck it is I do. But I think you're right. I think the point that Ferguson is making is getting to the point where somehow or another you don't give a fuck.
Yeah.
Like, it's hard, but like when I started the podcast, I'd let it go. I'm not going to have a TV show. I'm not going to be that big a comic. I don't know what this is going to do, but I got to do something before I have to figure out another job.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
But like, I felt it in my heart, and I've talked about this before, that I let it go. Like, you know, how long do you hold on? How long do you remain delusional? To you know, to where it becomes a liability, where people are like, no, he doesn't know it's over. You know what I mean? You don't want to be that guy. You know,
I hope I'm not that guy.
You're not that guy because you have self-awareness. But the freedom of not giving a fuck, you know, and then having this thing work out you know, on my own terms and like whatever was great, you know, because like now everything's sort of like, yeah, I'd like to do that and I'm ready to do that.
Yeah.
Like that's the other thing you got to realize. It's that you're ready to do it. And that's a funny thing that we put these people in power, these these fucking executives that come and go. Like, you might need, like, that. They're always moving to other jobs. And we're, like, hanging on, you know, they're, like, the judge and the jury of this thing. And it's, like, they don't, what do they know?
Right.
It's a fucking crapshoot for them, too. They're, like, I don't know, should we do it? It looks a little risky. Like, I don't want to take the hit. All right, well, fuck it. Let's not do it. Yeah, it's, like, that's the decision.
Right.
You know, I'm not going to hang my career on this.
And I love that showbiz is at that level now where it's, like, I'm going to go all the way around you guys. I just went around you.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you noticed, but I'm around you now.
Well, you know, you ultimately want to work with people, and if they're going to support what you do, you want to. It's all collaborative. You can't, right. You know, on that level, if you want to be in the box, you know, and be, you know, have the money that someone's going to give you, you know, that's the other thing is this weird kind of like parental relationship. It's like, I'm ready, mom, dad, I'm ready to work. Can I have the money now? You know, like.
Right.
You got to get past that emotional shit. But the other thing is, it's like, what, like, where is it really now? Like, there's so many fucking channels and stuff. You know, you just, all we want to do is earn an honest living.
Well, I think that's what helped me be at this place where you don't care as much is that you can go around. Like,
yeah.
I just did a special where I had two investors give me the money and we made it. And like, I started this tour. I just said, fuck it. I just start trying things because there's ways with the podcast and social media to get things out. Like,
yeah.
I had people going, because I started this tour called Outside the Box, right? Where fans, and I'm not the first guy to ever think of doing this, but I kind of just kind of gave it a name.
Yeah.
And said, I want see if you fans can bring me to your city some way. I go, here, I put the tour name on my website. Here's how to do it. So, you know, there's just so many ways now. And like when the fans heard me on different radio stations talking about how they can bring me to their city to do some sort of charity or, you know, it's not charity. It's like a fundraiser, whatever you want to raise money for. And I even got a sponsor.
Did it work?
Yeah, it just started. I've had like two of them.
How
so
the
far.
Shows?
They're awesome because it's like it's your fans, and then they bring other people that they think would like you.
It's great.
It's usually people with kids and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And this Yards Brewing Company started supporting it. You know, at least in this where they sell their beer,
right?
Which is like Philly and South Jersey, and they're trying to slightly broaden, but they're like a real niche market. And I was like, I said to the guy on the phone, like, I'm literally like, I'm my own salesman now. I'm on the phone with the head guy of the beer company. Yeah. And I'm like, dude, I go, I don't know if this is going to sound insecure or negative. I go, but I don't know a comedian that wouldn't love every gig being 2 hours from his house. I'll do these every week.
Right.
He goes, you know, we can do shows in the brewing company. We have this whole tasting room that we can like put a stage in. We can, because these guys are huge comedy fans.
Right.
That's how it happened.
Right. The Yards Brewing Company?
I like opened for Bill Burr in front of, it's like I use that as a selling tool.
Sure.
I contacted Bill. I go, dude, you're doing the Wells Fargo Center. That's 16,000 people in Philadelphia where I'm from. Can I open for you? Because I think I could like, that could help strengthen my thing there.
Yeah.
And he's like, sure. So it was fucking awesome. I put all my jokes together that were like perfect for a Bill Burr audience.
Yeah.
I mean, and killing in front of 16,000 people in your home city was just like the greatest buzz. And Bill backstage is going, I don't know if I love these big shows. I like the 3,000.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah,
and I was like, I came off stage. I go, Bill,
you're gonna love it.
I could do this every night. This, you're crazy. This is incredible.
When was that?
That was like 6 months ago.
Yeah.
And these people from Yards were in the audience. They hired me to do some corporate event. This was classic. I put like dress pants and a dress shirt because I think it's a corporate event.
Right.
It's a brewing company. I get there. It's all dudes with tattoos and beards, all like hipsters.
Yeah.
And like you couldn't say a joke that was too off color for them.
Right.
Like they just loved everything. And I was like, dude, we gotta do something together here. Let's do some sort of, you guys should sponsor my tour. And then like I said, I'm
in Pennsylvania,
in Jersey.
Yeah.
This is fucking perfect. And like I'm on the phone with fans, and they're like, you use social media for like kind of what it's for. That's kind of a great idea. I'm like, am I the only guy? And then I I told it on DePaulo's podcast. Yeah. And then he starts trying to do the same thing.
Oh, yeah. How's it going for him?
I don't know, because I know he's trying to do it on this massive level, like give me $14,000 for one show in your backyard,
right,
kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I'm like telling the fans, I'm like, no, I'm trying to make it affordable. I want you to make money. You're the producer. You make money. I make money.
I think that's an interesting thing about a lot of us now is that, you know, in the way that show business has changed, it's, I feel like I actually feel like I'm making an honest living. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, that I'm working hard and I'm doing it on my own and I'm getting paid for it, even with the TV show, because until you get at that, because there was years where they, I don't know if you ever got one of those development deals where they
did, yeah.
But then you're like, oh, well, what does this money mean? Well, it means that if you don't deliver, someone's going to make note of that. I have this weird principle with that shit. I like doing my own shit. Like, even the TV show, IFC doesn't pay, like, FX or, like, or in my fame is not, like, Louise or anyone or Bills. But, like, it's where I can handle it, and I'm making a living,
right,
and I'm saving a little money. And that's all you really want, really. Right. Like, I don't understand why guys, like some guys who are billionaires, why are they working? Why are you working? Isn't the idea to stop?
Exactly, yeah. Well, like, I even feel that with this week and pitching the shows that I'm like, I'm thinking so much smaller than I used to think. It's right. Like, I used to be like, I want to get my own show, and I want, oh my God, I could get crazy famous.
Yeah.
Now I'm like, I just want to get a little deal so I can buy, I want to buy a rental property, like a small one, right, in a resort area.
What made you hit the wall? Because, like, it seems like from when I first met you, from bro guy to rage guy, that there must have been some, like, cathartic moment where you're like, I got to fucking change. Was it meeting your wife?
Yes. It
was.
100%.
She loved you, and she was like, what are you doing?
There was moments where, well, first, when we were, before we were even married, there was, you might need to go see somebody, you need therapy.
And she was already, was she in school, was she a therapist, or
she, when we first started dating, she was finishing up her master's at Drexel.
Mm-hmm.
And then 7 months into our relationship, she wanted to take, they have to do a 1-year internship, mm-hmm, to get the PhD.
Mm-hmm.
I still kick myself because I think we picked the wrong place, but she had it narrowed down to UCSD in San Diego,
mm-hmm,
and in San Francisco. Those were her two places
to do the internship. Yeah.
But I remember thinking, because it was a 2-year internship, yeah, in San Francisco.
Right.
And I remember thinking, 2 years, that's just so long, which isn't. But now, as an older guy,
yeah,
when you were that age,
yeah,
you're like, I can't live in San Francisco.
I don't want to be away from Philly and New York for 2 years. You have fucking,
well, this
like
is
an idiot
I,
now.
I, this is what was weird, is I lived in LA for a year and a half, and I was that guy that was like, show businesses and everything, I want a wife and kids. I remember thinking that. My friends,
you knew that then?
Yeah, my friends were like, what are you, fucking crazy? I had the development deal, I was blowing through all the money living here, and I lived in Burbank.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, just buying stupid shit because I wasn't working. I'm living in LA, I'm just spending the development
renting
deal
in
money.
Burbank.
Yeah,
spending your 200 grand.
Yeah, just spending,
yeah,
buying couches and buying people dinners everywhere we, yeah, go. And then I had a little bit of money left, I moved back, and my brother, the real estate
contractor
guy, goes, dude, you should buy a place in Hoboken. I go, I never even heard of Hoboken. He's like, Hoboken, it's right outside of New York City. It's a good spot. You should buy a place there. So I look, I find an apartment, I buy it, fix it up a little.
Yeah.
Thank God that I bought that place, because I think that was just enough to make my PhD wife, because I met her like 3 months after coming back.
Yeah.
And she was at Drexel, so that's Philly.
Yeah.
I start doing gigs down there, and me owning this place was, like I said,
was it a two-bedroom?
It was a two-bedroom. Thought I was going to rent it out. I had like a couple comics stay there. I, yeah, was like, I can't no, do this.
They'll
no
ruin
way.
It. They'll make it garbage.
Yeah.
Like, you've got a shot at making a nice thing here.
Yeah.
Just give it to a comic for a month. It's like, what, yeah, happened?
And it was across the street from Artie Lang, which I didn't know at the time.
So he could use it as a crack house. Or the equivalent.
So Artie and I started to become friends.
Yeah.
I started working with him a lot on the road. And then I meet my wife. I start dating her. And she's like, wow, you're fixing up the place. She thought I wasn't even like heterosexual when she first met me. Like,
oh, yeah.
That's how into making the place nice I was.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Like, I had it like pimped out when she came over the first time. She's like, "You sure you like women?" I'm like, "Yeah, I swear I do. I do. I just like, I like candles."
I want things to be nice.
I like it nice.
Could you not touch that, please? Can you?
Yeah. And then I ended up selling it and making some money. So my brother was right. And that ended up getting us our first house.
So you went and put it right into a house. That was smart.
Yeah, but then I lost it all on that first house because it was
bubble?
The bubble. Yeah. The bubble, and it was in a shitty school district. I didn't have kids yet, and I didn't realize that that was important.
So you took the hit because you paid too much for the house? You sold it at a loss?
Yeah. Mm. My mother-in-law, never forget her, classic. She comes with us to look at the house.
Yeah.
She goes right up to the owner. "We'll take it. We love it." Doesn't even consult me. So yeah. I have to pay asking price for the house, which I would have bid it down, you know, or tried to do something, but
there was no way for you to go like, whoa.
That's my mother-in-law. This is me. I probably should have done that, but this is before I heard the Alu Bell episode. There is no confidence in anything. There were moments where I can remember vividly my wife saying, "I'm not saying I'm going to divorce you, but if you don't get on meds, like, there's a chance that this isn't going to work out."
Why, were you yelling at her?
I wouldn't yell at her, but I would...
Yell around her?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember a vivid moment trying to pour gas that my car ran out of gas in her mom's driveway, and I went to like a Target and bought a gas can, and I must have bought the wrong nozzle, and I couldn't get it in the gas hole.
Right.
So gas was just running down the side.
Yeah.
And I was just going, "Motherfucker!"
Yeah.
Loud. And my wife comes over. She's like, "I grew up on this street. Everybody's outside. My mom's in. What are you doing? You're embarrassing me." There was a lot of moments of embarrassment.
Like, I used to, it's so sad. I used to do that where you'd yell, like, on the street, like, in conversation. Oh, yeah. Like, even if you're not yelling at them, you're your pitch is like, and you don't even know it because you're just an angry guy.
Yeah.
And they're like, "Why is this happening? We're online at the movies." You know? Just the embarrassment of the woman with the rage guy.
Yeah, I was that guy. And then when it hit ground zero is when I got fired from a comedy club. This is what made Fixing Joe start as the podcast. So I got fired at a club in Hartford, Connecticut, two nights in a row, lost it at different hecklers.
What was that called, the Frog or the, what was that Hartford club?
This one was called City Steam.
Oh, hmm.
It was there for 100 years. It's still there. It's like a weekend room. The first night it was a bachelorette party with like 40 people in the audience. And I was like, I was aware enough to know that I'm going to lose it because they were fucking yelling at
you
the feature.
You opened it? You opened with losing it?
Well, they were featured. Whenever the guy before me is like, getting shit on, when I like take it like I'm the big brother now.
Yeah.
And I would go on stage and I would just, lost it. I made them cry. Like, I think a girl cried and left.
You and Nick DiPaolo.
Nick DiPaolo'd it.
Yeah.
They left.
They left during the show.
Oh, yeah. And then the show was great, you know, once you get them out of there.
They just shamed them out.
Yeah.
And the rest of the crowd was like, yeah.
Yeah. We love you. Fist pumping me on the way out. That was great. That was great.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, the manager's really mad.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next night, some loud Italian guy, and I held it in for the whole set.
Mm-hmm.
And then the set was done. I see that I got the light. I'm at 45 minutes.
Yeah.
And then I just said, you know what? I did all my material. I ignored you for 45 minutes, but I'm basically done. Now I'm going to tell you how I really feel about you. And I just went off on this guy for so long that they had they shut the mic off.
While you were on stage?
Just no mic now.
Was people there?
Oh, yeah. The full audience.
Were you doing well?
I did great up until then.
Oh, then it got bad?
Well, once again, the crowd would like you said, how you love it. Yeah. A lot of people loved it. That's where I would get in a problem. And then,
but you know that moment where you're like, the crowd's sort of like, nah, it's a little too far.
I don't think I could afterwards. Yeah. I was that guy that went.
Oh, no. I knew like when you're in it with somebody and you're like, you really feeding the anger and then you feel the crowd's with you. And then there's one beat where they're like, no.
yeah. When you say something really harsh.
Right. Nah. No. Yeah.
It's usually like saying, I want you to die.
Or
something that was a joke connected to them dying
the
on the way
home.
The word
cunt will do that.
Cunt can do it.
Yeah.
Definitely. So the manager called me the next morning in the hotel. And he's like, hey, man, you know, I'm a big fan, but I can't have you do another show here.
Yeah.
It's just, you know.
And you were booked for another one? It was a whole nother night? Was that the Friday?
I'm trying to. You know what it was? I think the Thursday was the first one.
They let you do Friday and then Saturday.
And then Saturday, you're gone.
Yeah, the middle moved up.
The middle,
you went to protect. He got his big shot.
Yes.
Hey, Joe, thanks for looking out for me. I'm doing your dates.
So stupid me thought in my head, this could be my hook, because I used to like to try to find ways.
The rage hook? The snap guy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I had a moment. And also, I have an album that I sell that is all snaps.
You recorded it all?
I recorded 11 different. I went back when I started thinking, oh, this is a hook.
Yeah.
And I realized I had a lot of recordings of losing it.
Yeah.
And I went, I was like, let me find the best ones. And,
yeah.
And you know, when there's a comic you really like look up to, there's like certain comics. When they come up to you and tell you they like a bit, it makes you go, oh,
yeah.
Like
it makes that.
You're like, oh,
yeah.
Attell was one. If Attell goes, that bit, I like that.
Yeah.
Or you, like when you said, even though I still think that bit's not funny.
It's just the beat.
The beat.
I don't know. Because I remember it. Maybe not everyone remembers it.
Maybe it's honest. I don't know.
No, it's the futility of it. Was the Atari game was when you just had Pong, right?
We had Pong.
Yeah, and then there was that one level where it was just you and the wall.
And the wall.
There's no winning. That's what was funny to me. There's no point to it.
Oh, see? You intellectualized.
Yeah, I did.
I don't think the crowd ever did.
All right.
Thank you. I need a room of Marc Maron's.
You don't have to do that joke anymore.
So where was I at the story?
Oh,
so,
no, your hook, your new hook.
Oh, so I think... So I start piecing together a comedy album, and I can remember sitting at the Cellar, and I say, Bill Burr's there, and I go, dude, I'm thinking of making an album that's just all my worst moments.
Yeah.
Like all losing it heckling beats. And he goes, dude, I'd buy that.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, I'm making it then. I got it. Yeah. And I narrated them at the beginning. And still to this day, like if I pitch that on stage, they don't want my fucking albums where it went well. They're like, whoa, forget those. Where's the one where you lose it? I'm like, it's this one. It's called When a Comedian's Attack. They're like, give me that. Yeah, sign that. Yeah, that's all. That's the one they want. They love it.
And do they still?
Yeah, still to this day. Like, I'm like, I'm out of them. They're like, oh, that's what we want those. You got more. I'm like, you can buy it on iTunes. It's there.
When Comedians Are Attacked?
You know what sucks, though, is those things go in loops on, like, Spotify and Pandora. Yeah. And I'm like, someone could be listening to a stand-up loop of, like, Louie.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, you hear me going, fuck yeah. Like, they don't even know, where did this come from?
Well, you make a couple bucks. What do you
still
care?
Coming?
Yeah.
So I thought I had this hook of the snap.
Yeah.
Because I had one of them on stage where the crowd was shitting on me, then I was shitting on them, then they would shit on me, and I made it a little like ad lib in the moment bit about it where we were keeping track.
Yeah.
Who got what? I'm giving them points.
Yeah.
We were just shitting on each other, and it was like really working. I was like, this is what it's going to be. And I did the first Fixing Joe episode after I got fired. Bill Burr, I figured perfect guest because he has that famous outrage in Philly.
Yeah.
And he's like, dude, that's a terrible idea. You don't ever want to be arguing as your career. You can't fake lose it.
He said he wanted the... Oh, fake lose it. Right.
Well, he was like, you can't... how are you going to get... And he goes, it's like...
The album is real losing it.
Yes, it's real. Yeah. But I found the funniest ones.
Right.
There is one track on that album where I give myself a loss.
Oh, really?
I think the heckler won.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I hate when that happens.
She was fucking brutal. This girl just was... Oh she was tearing me up.
Good for her.
Yeah. But Burr was like, that's like being on a sitcom playing some... over-exaggerated character now it lasts 12 years.
You can't
make
it on purpose, yeah.
Yeah, he goes, you wouldn't be happy. You wouldn't be creatively happy.
Right.
So I kept doing the podcast. But yeah, the psychologist's wife, having kids makes you fix yourself too.
You're How old are your kids now?
8 and 4.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you got to show up, and that's something you wanted to do. That's not something you fell into. Like, you left here thinking you wanted to have a family and live that life. You left L.A. that first time. Like, I want to have a wife and kids and be a person.
It was very important to me
right.
to have both.
So because of that, you shaped up.
Yeah. Well, there, yeah, I can remember moments where I would just, where I thought I was going to get divorced, and I could, like, this is when I just had a son. I remember my wife and I having a fight, seeing his bedroom from our bedroom right after the fight, and just, like, bawling, being like, I can't, I don't want to not be here sleeping in this house with my family. Like, this, oh, like, a divorce is easier when you don't have kids, but if you have kids and you're like, you're not here anymore.
It's always awful.
What I say on stage is, it'd be hard to witness the guy who's the improved version of you.
Yeah, right, right, right. You're doing a better job.
Yeah, he, you know, because I'm ADD, you know, bad, and this guy's all focused. I know it wouldn't be another comedian. She's not going down that road again.
No, who would?
Yeah, like, do you see everything that you, did that happen with you in your divorces, where the next guy was like a total opposite of you?
No, I don't know. You know, I don't have to deal with them.
Yeah, you don't have to hang.
I know the first wife's dude. He's a good dude. He's a teacher, and she's a psychologist.
Right.
So they worked out. Like, and I'm happy about that, because there was no way. Like, I'm not even sure I'm the greatest emotional investment now. You know, like the second wife, I know why she left. You know, and I know what I did. And she ended up marrying a dude, got some bread, and he's a writer, and she, you know, he's in show business and stuff. I think they're okay, but like, they both did the right thing. But it doesn't make me feel any better.
Right.
So wait, so now your wife, though, does she have a private practice?
No. See, I let the audience think that my wife is a therapist. Yeah. My wife actually is a neuropsychologist with a PhD and studies Alzheimer's disease. Uh-huh. She does 100% research. She's like a scientist.
Okay. She never wanted to do the therapy?
No, she wasn't interested. I mean, she has
to. She's a researcher.
Researcher. But you have to learn everything.
Yeah.
You know, there were times where she had to do therapy. I can remember when we were dating, she had a couple of patients. They make you learn everything. But no, she has a lot of friends and psychiatrists that she can, like, tap into. Like,
yeah.
When I knew what medication, like,
how long did it take you to level off on that shit? How much has it changed? Like, I never really embarked on the medication. I here and there, but not much. But you sound like you're all for it.
100% for it. The web series kind of starts from the beginning of me starting the meds and takes you through it.
Yeah.
It takes about 2 months before they really even are doing anything.
Yeah.
So it's this slow progression.
Yeah.
Then all of a sudden you're like, oh, that thing that I think I even tried to write something about that, about it being like a phantom type feeling. Yeah. But yeah, it's weird. It's like it's in a headlock. I think I've heard you describe...
Right,
medication.
Like, yeah, I remember the one. It does give it gives you new personality, but it doesn't get rid of the old one.
Yeah.
The old one's inside going, "What are we doing?"
Yes,
right. Yeah. And the new one's like, "Take it easy, we're okay."
Yeah, it's like it's in a headlock.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It wants to fight, but it can't.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But your kids are all right.
that's a good one to ask. Well, I think my son has some of the stuff.
How old is he?
It's another joke I do. You notice your negative traits way quicker than your positive traits in your own children.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Like, he has some of the...
Rage?
Maybe. And then he has psychologist mom who's like, tell us your mood.
Yeah.
I wrote all these... she wrote, like, faces on a piece of paper, like, from a smiley face to a little smiley to a nothing to a sad.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're trying to, like, map out his moods.
Oh,
I'm like, oh, no. Oh, no.
Psychologist kid.
Yeah.
Now he's 8. And the daughter's 4?
Yeah. So he's in third grade. And, she's too young to
But decide. They're having a good time?
It's awesome. I feel like you're working towards the ending. I feel this now. This is what I was going to say. This, when you listen to somebody's show.
A lot.
And you listen to it a lot. You're like, you're waiting for
that. Wrapping up.
Are you good? You're waiting for it. I'm like, fuck, here comes the are you good. A day and a half of what's Mark going to ask me? Is this going to go well? Is he going to hate me? Am I going to be able to tell he wants me to go? He wants it to fucking end. He wants to get out. Like that shit. But then when you go do it.
Well, I didn't think any of those things.
I know.
Like, I was like, I don't even need to research this one.
Yeah, it's an easy one. Just fucking put a fucking shirt on and go do it.
Yeah, because you can talk to Joe. They're not going to freak out.
Yeah. You don't write shit down? Someone tells you to go see a movie, I write it down. It's got to go in the iPhone.
No, I kind of remember that stuff. But if I have an impulsive thought that I think I need to share, I better make sure it's not like a bomb of some kind. Do you know what I mean? Like, if I have feelings, like, I'm going to fucking email that guy back. And I'm like, yeah, maybe take a second. You know what I mean? Like, but now I've gotten so detached from it. I forget to text people back. I forget emails. Like, I just, like, I don't know where the fuck my brain's at. I don't know what's happening, but I just space it. I just, and then I'll be going through my text. I'm like, holy shit, I did not answer that guy at all. And that was 3 weeks ago. And then I'll just answer like he just texted it. Oh, no, I can't do it. Sorry.
Have you ever tried Adderall?
No.
Never?
No.
Yeah. Well, you couldn't now. But I have friends that are addicts that can take it if you take the time-released version, because you can't overtake time-released Adderall.
I don't know that I have ADD, though.
No, I don't think you do either. I can usually tell.
I have anxiety issues, and I also... I don't know what the other issue is. I seem to operate at my own pace. But like when I have to do jobs, I do them. You know what I mean? Like if left to my own devices, I do a lot of things at once and I usually get everything done. But there would probably be a more efficient way to do things that I don't always do.
Right.
Do you know?
I guess. But yeah, with me, it's the attention deficit. Like
you just space it out.
Well, I forget a lot. And you really notice it when you are an Adderall user and then you decide to try not taking Adderall one day. You're like, this is how I was? This is horrendous. I'm bumping my head constantly. It's just like, bang, bang. What? I get injuries because I'm just like, I'm not in sync really.
Really?
Yeah, I'm forgetting things.
It was always like that?
I can't drive very well.
Really?
Yeah. I can't read.
How old are you?
I'm 48.
So maybe, what, you don't think maybe it's just getting older?
No. And not being able to read a book without having to keep rereading the paragraph over and over again.
Yeah, but that's my whole fucking life. I mean, it's got to be interesting. Maybe you're not reading the right book.
But how about if you can tell it's interesting, but there's a little like radio playing and it's hard for you to focus? That's what I noticed it in my son when he's playing baseball.
Yeah.
And if there's something else going on the next field,
yeah,
and he's just looking over there, I'm like, dude, the guy just pitched it. You can't look to the right. You're going to get hit in the face. And he'll be like, I don't need to wear my cup today. I'm like, I think you do. I think you might want to wear it today.
Yeah.
He goes, I don't need it.
You might see a dog across the street that would distract you from fielding a grounder and protecting your balls.
It's hilarious. He's actually said to me, I don't need the cup because I'm playing in my my YBNR league is his lower level league, and then his travel league is the other one. I'm like, what is the difference?
Yeah.
People hit a ball at your balls. Yeah. You need the cup. I'm an idiot.
So that's what we've learned today, is that no matter where you are, if there are balls being hit, you should wear your cup.
Wear the cup.
And that's a metaphor, too, for life.
Yeah.
Always wear your cup.
That's the title of the pitch this week.
Is it?
Episode one, wear your cup.
Is it?
No.
It should be.
It should be.
All right, good talking to you.
You too, man.
Okay, Watch Joe's special. On CISO this Thursday. Go to WTFpod.com for all your WTF needs. Check the tour schedule. A lot of dates coming up. Going to be adding dates. I'll keep you in the loop on that. Be nice to people. There's no social mandate for being a douchebag in public. Let's try to be people. Can we? How about I play some distorted guitar for a minute for all those that hang in for this? Yeah. Boomerlet.